Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are collectively Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area. And our show aims to bring some culture to horticulture. I get a little lazy in the summer.
Oh, yeah.
I think everybody gets a little bit lazy. Our pace kind of slows down. We think about indulging ourselves more.
The living is easy.
Yep. We take time off. We go outdoors. And, of course, we eat. We probably eat more in the summer, I think. Some people think you eat more in the winter, but I think people eat more in the summer. There's just so much more, like, natural bounty and seasonal stuff available. So
tomatoes.
I know. I feel like summer is about pleasure. And you kind of wait all year for that, like, perfect peach, that corn, that gorgeous, juicy tomato, whether it's from your own garden or from the farmer's market. And it's like all there, ready to inspire you to taste it and to cook with it. So when Alice and I were thinking about a summer show, the word pleasure kept floating around, you know, in the ether. And I was personally thinking about my upcoming trip to Italy. I was focusing a lot about what I was going to eat when I was there.
All I think about is lobster rolls in the summertime.
Exactly. And I was reminded that, you know, there probably isn't a culture, a nation in the world more sort of attuned to the pleasures of life and the table than the Italians. I think it's just genetic.
Mm-hmm. It's in our DNA.
It's in our DNA.
Right.
So our guest today is going to help us explore pleasure. I think she epitomizes
pleasure at the table.
Pleasure at the table. Yes. Good point. Alice, thank you for clarifying. I don't want to put our guest in an awkward spot.
just saying.
Summer pleasures of the table. And I think she epitomizes for me, one of the people that epitomizes that Italian pleasure seeking principle, you know? She's a person that I follow on social media, and I find a lot of inspiration from, whether it's from her writing on her blog, her recipes, and even the like quirky and amazing paintings that she finds and shares with her followers. She has a very sort of unique personal sensibility.
I'm friending you now, yeah. Erica.
In fact, Alice, will you read a little bit about Erica DeMaine?
I will, yeah. Erica DeMaine is a chef, food writer, and teacher who specializes in healthy Italian cooking. She is the author of The Flavors of Southern Italy and Pasta Improvvista, as well as Williams-Sonoma Pasta, which is available at the Williams-Sonoma store. She's a member of the Association of Culinary Professionals and the Italian-based International Slow Food Movement, and she lives here in New York City. Erica, welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Now, this is not the first time that you've been on Heritage Radio Network, is it?
No, I was on the show twice before, a long time ago, with Patrick and Katie Kiefer, when they had a show together.
Yeah.
And we talked about food.
Yes, and we're going to talk about food today, but I want to start with paintings, because that's what drew me to you in the first place. You had a series of paintings on your blog called Women with Fish.
I still have it. It's an ongoing
project. Love it. I love it so much. So tell us about that project and what inspired you to do that particular sort of theme.
Well, actually what happened is when I was... You know, I put up art with my food blog instead of food photographs, because food photographs I was finding weren't really inspiring me, and I see a lot of them, and I was just kind of getting a a little bit, they were getting repetitious. So, I mean, years and years ago, I started putting up artwork and said artwork that reminded me of a recipe I was doing or a color in a painting that reminded me of some, you know, a piece of, I don't know, a tomato or something. And I always go on the internet and look for artwork when I'm trying to pair it with a recipe. And I think at some point I put in something like this. Is like several years ago, still life with squid, or it was something like that.
Yeah.
And because I was doing a squid recipe, and I just wanted to see what came up. And something came up that was a woman, a painting, I remember, a woman grabbing a large squid and holding it really close to her body. And and I just thinking, I said, okay, this I like. I don't know why I like it, but this is going to go up with my, you know, my squid recipe. And I put it up, and a lot of people, women mostly, really responded to this. It was a watercolor, I believe, and responded to it. And I couldn't get it out of my head. So then I started searching for other things in the same, you know, genre, like women with fish, women, you know, cooking fish, women, you know, just standing next to fish, anything. It was a very loose interpretation of this subject. And I found so much, and it just became a fascinating project. And I put them up, like, maybe, oh, I don't know, twice a month. And I just keep getting more. I keep finding more.
Okay, let me just read one of the excerpts from your blog, ericadomain.com, that's in the Women with Fish category. And this is your writing. So there's a illustration. It's like an etching, I guess, of maybe Venus and, I don't know, some man handing her a fish.
Oh, yes. Okay, I know which one that is.
And you write, oh, it's you again. I rejected the sardine, and now you're back with an underweight sea bass. There's no fish you can bring that will alter me. I won't gaze at the aggressive squint in your eyes. I don't like your nervy reach. I don't want the parched smell of your skin or the tautness of your hair. You are not of the sea. You just acquire it. Go away and leave my slippery mind. That is wonderful.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, it's great.
Oh, thank you. Well, no, I was just going to say, and another thing that evolved after about a year was me writing stories that go with the artwork. I mean, whatever I think is going on with the woman in fish image, I just sort of close my eyes and think about it for a while, and I let the lady usually in the artwork talk to me about something. And here she just didn't like this man bugging her, you know.
This
guy's been after her for a really long time.
Yeah.
And he comes back with various types of fish to win her over, and she always rejects them because she doesn't like the guy. And the last time it was a little sea bass, and that was sort of the last straw.
And that's what I love about what you do, is because so much now has become visual, but a very superficial kind of visual sharing. It's like,
right.
I like this, I like that. Look at this, look at that, you know? And
yeah.
And it's nice to...
It's too much. It's overwhelming, and it cancels...
Yeah.
That's what I feel about food. I love food photography, but frankly, I feel like it all cancels itself out. It's all very repetitive, and I just got bored with it, I think. I just didn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
It wasn't speaking to me about the food I was making or the feelings I was having when I was cooking or thinking about recipes.
Right.
The way artwork does.
It was more, it's more emotional. You can,
yes,
like
it's
you were
way
saying.
More emotional.
And
I mean, some people really get very emotionally worked up when they look at food photography, and I can see that, but there's just so much of it now.
Yes.
Well, and I feel like everybody does the same thing with the photographer.
That's kind of,
like,
true. I mean, you know, how different can a plate of spaghetti look like?
Right.
Really.
Right.
Yes.
You
right.
know, I mean, there's different calibers of food photography. Some are much better than others. But, you know, when you come right down to it, everybody sort of knows what that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't need to see it again. I need to see something or feel something that draws me deeper into my cooking. Mm-hmm. And that's why I chose artwork instead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you did. So let's talk about your blog, your site, and it has your name, Erica Demain, and then it's called Improvisation Italian Style, which I really love and I was really connected to because my husband, besides being a painter in a previous life, was also an improviser. He is one of the best improvisers. I've seen a lot of experimental theater in New York, Erica Demain,
probably
more than I ever want to or should have.
I can see
good and bad. I've seen good and bad. And he's one of the best improvisers I know. And I think because I don't have that quality, I really appreciate it in other people, you know? And I love that you bring the one area, though, that I do like to improvise is in the kitchen. I don't like to follow recipes. I'm a terrible baker because I have to, like,
I'm a terrible baker, too.
Awful.
I can't measure things.
Yeah.
So, it gets me very, very frustrated.
Yeah,
and I just wind up just winging it and, you know, a hit or miss. So
yeah, exactly.
I don't have a passion for sweet things particularly anyway, so I don't really miss it.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate wonderfully baked things, and I definitely have a sweet tooth, but baking doesn't lend itself to improvisation.
No,
really.
It's science.
No, it
baking is
it's for the most
science.
Part, that's absolutely true.
Yeah, so I love that about your cooking style, you know, because especially, we were talking about it in the sort of pre-interview. In Italy, in the very traditional kind of Italian cooking, there are rules. Certain herbs go with certain meats and fishes.
That's right.
Certain pasta shapes go with certain sauces. But I like that you kind of like break through those barriers and you know, really did take inspiration from what's around you, whether it's art or, you know, your garden. And I'd love for you to share with our listeners how your cooking philosophy got to that point. How did you get to that point?
You know, it was very interesting. When I first went to the town my grandparents were born in Italy, which is on the border of Puglia and Campania, I realized when I tasted, I believe it was just a plain tomato sauce, but it tasted exactly like the one my grandmother was still making. I mean, it was the exact same sauce. She just brought it with her intact. She came to New York. She wasn't influenced by anything around her. Well, she did grow up in an Italian community. But she just brought it with her, and it was just etched in stone.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not a bad thing. I love that continuity in cooking. But that wasn't the way I was growing up and feeling about food. I mean, everything she made was always exactly the same. You know, if you got her eggplant parmesan, you knew exactly what it was going to taste like. It was going to have basil in it. It was going to have sliced hard-boiled eggs in it. It was going to have a little bit of a tomato paste. You know, and it was predictable and it was delicious. But I just, you know, growing up in New York, I didn't have that kind of tradition really to fall back on as much because I took in everything from everywhere. I mean, I ate so much ethnic food growing up, and so did my parents.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we had, you know, Thai food as much as we had Italian food.
Right.
And, you know, it rubs off on you, and you see how big the world is. I mean, I think what I'd like to say about Italian cooking and the way mine evolved is that I try to stay true to the spirit of the Italian kitchen. I want somebody Italian to say when they taste my food, that tastes familiar to me. That tastes Italian. The flavors are familiar, but it's a little bit different. You know, it's slightly played with, slightly. I evolved it. I add things, but I don't want to lose the essence of the Italian spirit.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
a
I'm
good,
very,
yeah.
very, I guess, I'm very conscious of that, veering too much in one direction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would never put cilantro in a pasta sauce.
Right,
I wouldn't do it.
Right, yeah.
Because cilantro is not a herb they use in Italy.
Right.
And it tastes very non-Italian to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I draw the line.
Yes. I know. I have a very traditional, as we were talking before, I have a very traditional Italian family. I'm first generation, and my dad is more of an experimenter. My mom likes to follow the recipes exactly.
And the history.
And my dad will make statements like, my son, who's now like, you know, third generation, he's an American basically. He said, no, I had a great pizza that had chicken on. He goes, chicken on pizza? That's crazy.
Well, I don't
dad said, my son was like, why won't Nonna try the pizza with the chicken on it? And he's like, because chicken doesn't belong on pizza, according to Grandpa. He's like, and my son said, he's so narrow-minded, Mom. He's of that, you know. But I think done right, you know, not some kind of crazy mashup of cuisines,
right.
I think is good. And that leads me to my next question for you, because we're talking about gardening too. And you have, you know, you live in Manhattan. You know, you don't have tons of space to garden, and yet...
That's an understatement.
Yeah. you are able to get inspiration even from your small herb garden where you grow things. And one of the things that you talked about, one of the herbs that you talked about recently was mentucha, right?
Yes.
Which was an herb that I had never heard of, and I had thought I had heard...
Oh, really?
No, I had never used it. I had never heard... Nobody in my family had heard of it. Nobody had ever used it, and I was really intrigued. So, of course, I had to, like...
Google it
and figure out what the botanical name is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's calamintha. It's, like, related to catnip, right, actually?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. It's in the mint family. Actually, you know what? My family never used mentucha either. My father didn't grow it. He also had an herb garden, actually a backyard vegetable garden. I encountered mentucha for the first time on one of my first trips to Sicily. It's not something my family brought with them to this country. And it was with artichokes, used to flavor artichokes, and I was just intrigued by the flavor because it tasted familiar to me in as much as it tasted a little bit like oregano, but it was much softer and gentler and much more complex. And I became very interested in growing it here because I really couldn't get that taste out of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I did finally find it after I did the same research you did, and I found it was called calamint. And I found somebody at the Union Square Market who was selling little plants of calamint. And at first I wasn't sure it was going to be exactly the same, but I went home and planted it in one of my stoop pots, which is my herb garden. I have two stoop pots on either side of my building. And it took off like crazy because it is a wild mint.
Uh-huh.
And it tasted exactly the way I remembered it.
That's so great when that happens.
Yeah. So it's exactly the same plant as far as I can tell.
So in Sicily, it probably grows wild.
It does grow wild.
Yeah.
It grows all over the place. Actually, it grows wild all over central Italy, too. I mean, they use it in Tuscany. In Tuscany, it's paired with mushrooms. Hmm. That's the classic pairing. In fact, I hear, I've never seen it, but supposedly if you go to buy mushrooms in a market in places in Tuscany, the seller will wrap up a couple of sprigs of mentucha and put it in with your order.
Oh my God, you're making my mouth water right now.
I know, but I mean, that's so crazy.
Good.
That just goes to show how exactly some traditionally people cook in some places in Italy still.
Right.
That's what this herb is for.
So what else are you growing?
I mean, it has traditional uses. I've been using it in everything because I took the, I figured, you know, anything you really put in, use oregano or marjoram for, it sort of brings to mind.
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking, why not? I mean, I did a recipe for calamari and chickpea salad, and I used mentucha, and it came out beautifully.
So
I loved it.
I'm making swordfish tonight. Would you put it on swordfish?
Go for mentucha.
Yeah.
If you have it.
Yeah. I don't have it, but maybe I'll come to your house.
This is not going to give you exactly mentucha, but I found if you mix marjoram and a little bit of spearmint and then a smaller amount of either thyme or maybe summer savory.
Uh-huh.
If you mix those all together, you'll come up with something that is somewhat like mantucha.
Okay.
I mean, the closest I can find. Some people think it tastes like a mixture of oregano and basil. I don't quite get that, but you can try...
No, because it's got to have some mint in it, so it's got to have that
Basil is a mint.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Is that right? Yes. Yeah. So,
yeah.
I mean, basil has a minty taste, like, not really, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what else?
Anyway,
are you growing?
That's what I came up with. I've been using that mix for a couple of years before actually finding the herb. So you might try that.
Okay. So tell me what else you're growing and cooking that's like off the beaten path.
Oh well, first of all, my garden is only herbs because all I have are the two stoop pots, and then I have three sunny window sills.
Uh-huh.
And that's my entire, this is like urban gardening to the extreme.
Right.
It's like really, I mean, I don't have a backyard anything or a patio or anything.
But it sounds like it's the
combinations.
I really
wanted to grow wild fennel.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for the first time last summer, and it took off like crazy. I found it at the Union Square Market again, and I planted it again, and it's fantastic because they use that in pasta con le sarde, the classic Sicilian dish of pasta with sardines, and it always has wild fennel. And using fennel seeds or bulb fennel was never quite good enough. It never gave me the right taste, so I wanted to grow my own. So now I can make a very traditional pasta con le sarde. And I'm actually looking at my plant right now. It's looking really beautiful. And it's starting to go to seed, which is nice because then I can harvest some fennel pollen maybe even if I get enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that going. Yeah. What else odd things do I have? I always like lemon verbena, and that's really hard to find in stores. So
yes,
I have that.
Yeah.
I have a beautiful big lemon verbena plant. I may use that. I actually have some sitting in a box, a bottle of cold vodka in my freezer.
Oh.
And I haven't tasted it yet, and I think it's going to be really good. And the mantucha. And I'm also growing Thai basil, which I love.
Uh-huh.
And that's hard. I never see that in any grocery store.
No.
I mean, just regular basil.
Yeah.
And marjoram, which is actually my favorite herb, it's not impossible to find, but it's hard to find.
Yeah,
yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's easy to grow, actually. Marjoram is I think of it as a sort of sweeter, milder cousin to oregano, basically.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's a little bit more floral, right?
Yes.
And oregano always grows like crazy. I mean, and the marjoram does too. Well, I think they're botanically related, yes?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
And I love to grow tarragon. I know you can buy it.
I love tarragon,
but I love tarragon.
It's such a unique taste.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. I'm growing tarragon right now. I'm looking at it out my window right this moment. It's looking very, very healthy. Tarragon is another thing that's strange. It's not really used in the Italian kitchen.
No.
I think of it as French.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, French.
Absolutely. Yeah. But there have been some Italian dishes where, like, I have, you know, frittatas and stuff where I used it. And it gave a certain kind of special taste.
It's a very unique, distinctive taste, tarragon.
Yeah, and Italians should like it because it has a fennel-y taste, and they're very big on using, fennel seeds and fennel-y type, aniseed type tasting herbs. And but I think it's hard to say why they don't use it. I really don't know the answer to that. I think it was because it was originally sort of an Eastern European herb. Maybe it came from Russia, I read.
Oh, really?
I think so. And then found its way into the French kitchen. But the Italians, maybe because they already had so much wild fennel and basil, which also has a slight fennel-y taste, to me at least, and anise. Maybe they just didn't use it, but for me, I love it because it's very subtle and it's really unique. It's absolutely beautiful. Beautiful.
So tell us a little bit about the Williams-Sonoma pastas, because I know those are some great combinations. How did you stumble into that line of commerce?
You mean doing the book for Williams-Sonoma?
Yeah.
My first book was called Pasta Improvisata, which means improvisation. And they saw that, and I think were selling it in the stores, and liked it, and then asked me to do the pasta book for one of their series. You know, they, most of their books are in series, and they're small books, and they asked me to do the pasta book because they'd seen my first book. So that's how I got that, little gig, and it was great.
Can you tell us some of the recipes in there?
I'm so embarrassed. I mean, you know, the thing is, they wanted a lot of classic things.
Yes.
I remember when I spoke with them, but they wanted a lot of things, like they wanted, you know, bolognese sauce, a very classic bolognese sauce. They wanted a classic, you know, Southern Italian lasagna. They wanted an Alfredo sauce. They wanted a carbonara. They wanted things like this. And that was half the book. And the other half was were things that were more improvisational and a little bit more contemporary. So that's how the book was, that's how it was laid out. Yeah, so.
Well, we have to take a break, Erica.
Okay.
Just for a couple of minutes. Stay on the line. When we come back, we're going to talk more about pleasures of the table and Italian cooking.
Okay, my pleasure.
You're listening to Now by Spiral Jetty Club. Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Washed rind cheeses are a fairly recent addition to the repertoires of artisanal cheesemakers in the United States. These cheeses tend to be stinkier than other types and are often high on the list of connoisseurs. Now, Whole Foods Market has come up with one of their own. The raw cow's milk cheese made by Sprout Creek Farm in Poughkeepsie, New York, is washed with six-point ale from Red Hook, Brooklyn. The beige sticky rind deepens in color as it ages. The satiny ivory cheese within is mellow with a sweetly tangy bite and a grassy aroma. The current version features 6-point diesel, which is in limited supply, so stop by and pick up some before it's gone. And point of origin cheese is sold exclusively at Whole Foods Market in New York, Northern New Jersey, and Connecticut. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Hi, I'm Amy Mills from 17th Street Barbecue in Southern Illinois, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We are here with Erica Demain, chef, food writer, and teacher who specializes in healthy Italian cooking. That's almost, I don't know if it's a contradiction or or if it's redundant. It's kind of both.
Well, I think it grows out of my love for the Mediterranean diet.
Oh, yeah.
It's really...
Yes, I was reading about the whole Mediterranean diet thing, right? Where it came from. And it came from, I believe, a small town where Ernest Hemingway kind of disappeared for a little while in southern Italy, in Campania.
Many towns that he disappeared into.
Yes. Well, he disappeared into this fishing town in southern Italy.
And he never looked particularly healthy, right?
I know.
No, no.
All that drinking.
No, he wasn't part of the study. But for some reason...
Thank God.
I know. He might have written about fish, but he probably didn't eat that much. This town, I forget the name, it escapes me right now, but the researchers somehow stumble upon this town because everybody lives so long. And that was the basis of the original, like, Mediterranean, the concept of the Mediterranean diet before it, like, trickled down into sort of everybody's...
Today Show.
Yeah, exactly. So you mentioned, Erica, that you're from Your family originally is from a town between, sort of like on the border between Campania and Puglia. And I'd like to ask you to tell us about your family and food traditions and what, you know, tastes and flavors like they brought with them that you really like.
Well, the thing about this town is that this is really right in the middle of the country. It was a very poor little town. I've been there several times. And it's very dusty, very impoverished. I think about 600 people are left in this town. And, you know, they didn't have access to a lot of things. They had no fish. They had very little meat. Meat was, you know, special occasion things. And when this is my father's side. When his parents came over here, it's interesting because the way my grandmother cooked, there was very simple foods, but I remember these strange tastes. Like, I mean, she was very into things that were bitter. Like, we had a lot of bitter, like, greens that we were always served. And she actually used to, you know, forage dandelions from, like, Westchester, you know, on the golf courses to the, you know, embarrassment of her family, I might add. But, you know, we ate that stuff. And a lot of things, I just remember, you know, very gnarly chicories that they would grow in the garden and escarole, which I love. Yeah. But we'd eat it all raw and arugula. Mm-hmm. I think my family was one of the first families in the neighborhood. I grew up on Long Island primarily to grow arugula because one of our neighbors smuggled some back. The wild arugula, the spiky kind, smuggled it back from, I believe, Sorrento. And my father grew it in his backyard, and it took off like crazy. It grew for years and years, and nobody even knew what it was. Like, I mean, you couldn't even find it in stores then. And we ate that, and it was really intensely bitter. And I don't know, these bitter flavors really remind me of my grandmother. She wasn't particularly bitter. She maybe
was
a little bit
depressed. That's a great sentence.
I know.
But anyway, bitter tastes remind me of her. Vinegary things, I think, to bring out flavor in vegetables that she'd eat, like, over and over again, you know, like zucchini or a pumpkin or something, would always have, like, sort of a... be preserved in vinegar.
Yes.
And these puckery tastes really remind me of her. And puckery and bitter, and and also soothing things like ricotta.
Yeah.
I mean, ricotta, she put on everything.
Yeah.
I mean, everything had a dollop of ricotta. And so you'd have sort of like maybe a platter of vinegary eggplant that was sort of like leathery.
Oh,
you know what
my
I'm saying?
God.
Like dry.
I'm having flashbacks as we speak, Erica.
Right?
Wait, isn't this a pleasure show?
I know, but you know.
That and then ricotta next to it.
Yes.
Well, the ricotta cools it down.
Tooth breaking tarali that always had fennel seeds in them.
Yeah.
Tooth breaking. And I was like, this is the best. You know, it's like, oh my God, this is horrible. But you know.
Well, they were delicious though.
Yeah.
But they were really hard.
Oh, I know.
And I actually saw a picture of my hometown, which was called Castelfranco in Miscano, is the name of it, of some, you know, Saints Day procession. I don't remember what saint it was, but I saw it on the internet, actually, because I put my town in. And it was like a whole, you know, procession, and the saint was draped around her neck were just these, just draped and draped with tarali.
They're pretzels, basically. Yeah, they're circular, hard pretzels.
Yeah, you've brought them back for me.
Yeah.
And there's just these hard little sort of biscuit things. Mm-hmm. And but anyway, that tastes taste of the fennel seeds in that really reminds me of her cooking. And you know, we had a lot of other things in our house. We had a lot of shellfish, which I think is maybe something that. Maybe came from the Sicilian side of my family, my mother's side. But I don't really know very much about that side of my family because her parents died very, very young, and I didn't know them. And she kind of drifted away from that side. I think maybe it was a little sad for her.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't really meet that many relatives, and she kind of moved over to my dad's side of the family. But I remember eating a lot of shellfish, and I still love shellfish. It is my favorite thing to eat, I have to say. I mean, any form. Shellfish with pasta, I mean, that's about as good as it gets for me.
I know. But, that's very much a memory that I have of eating in Italy. Growing up, yeah. When you were talking about the
bitter... Well, you grew up on the water.
Well,
so
no.
You would have had those things in your family.
No, well, we were mountain people.
You were mountain people? I thought you were in the water.
No,
okay.
We weren't near... We had my mom and dad... You know, I mean, all the bitter taste that you were talking about, that leathery eggplant, that was like lunches, you know. It was horrible as a kid getting these like pickled on... I told Alice about it once. I said there were two choices, the pickled eggplant or zucchini, right?
Right.
On Wonder Bread, which is a disgusting combination.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Because it, like, is spongy,
English,
you know?
Muffins.
But you're in America!
Awful. Or the other choice was a big slab of mozzarella on Wonder Bread. My mother's compromise was, well, I'm not going to give you the hard, crusty bread that you don't really like, so I'll give you the American bread, but I'm going
to
give you this...
But you still have to eat the miserable, leathery eggplant.
Oh, yeah. I was like, this is horrible. Nobody wanted
Italian to Italian in the center, American on the outside.
Oh, my God.
And that's like what I am.
Yeah.
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 Right?
Yeah.
That sort of sums my being up pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we had all sorts... Yeah, I remember... Actually... What I make now, which is along the same line, is I make a vinegared zucchini, but it's like kind of an agro dolce kind of thing. It's a sweet and sour, and I let it marinate, and then I top it off with mint leaves, which is a very traditional Sicilian way to prepare it. And it's a little gentler.
That's how we do pickles in the South.
Yes, a little sweet and sour. Otherwise it's too...
Agro dolce is very big in Southern Italy, you know, and it's... Especially in Sicily, I see a lot of it. I mean, it's a way to, you know, preserve things, but also a way to heighten things.
Right.
And I love that taste combination now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I make a lot of that. A lot of things get the sweet and sour treatment. Fish, sardines... I love that.
So your first book was about... Well, you said your first book was the Pasta Improvvisata, right?
Yeah.
And then you did the Flavors of Southern Italy, right?
Yes.
Now,
yes.
That book is interesting because, you know, I'm married to a Midwesterner, right?
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so Italian food, when I came into the family, certain members of the family welcomed me, you know, into their kitchens and were like, here's someone who can cook real Italian food. And other people were like, no, we have to go to Olive Garden, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it made me think about how Americans think about Italian Southern food, you know?
Oh, yeah. You know, this is a problem. I mean, not so much anymore because I think at this point, the cooking of the Mezzogiorno is really having its day now.
Yeah.
I mean, Sicily is popular now and Campania and Puglia. Mm-hmm. People are discovering how beautiful Puglia is. I mean, the landscape and the food. And there are really good restaurants now, not just, you know, Olive Garden stuff. But, yeah, when I was growing up, everybody thought it was just sloppy, cheesy, red sauce mess.
Yeah.
And, you know, the truth is, in my family, we did have that kind of sloppy, cheesy mess occasionally, I must say, and I loved it.
Yeah.
But more often, you know, the food was very streamlined and kind of elegant, and I don't think that people who weren't Italian-Americans ever really saw that side of our cooking.
Yeah.
I mean, oftentimes my mother would make, you know, she'd make like an escarole salad or dandelion salad and just make a fried cutlet. And that would be our dinner,
right?
Served over the salad. Or she'd make something like, let me see, you know, roast chicken with lemon, just squeezed lemon pieces all over it, and serve it with a side of roasted potatoes that were flavored with, like, fresh rosemary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my mother used to make that a lot. And that was the dinner. And then you'd have a salad afterwards, maybe.
That's it.
And
fruits.
That's not what most people think of as Southern Italian cooking.
No,
but
you're absolutely right.
I grew
right.
up on that kind of food, and I loved it. It was beautiful, really.
I agree.
And it was very, very simple, but very, very, I mean, really have to say, very elegant.
And also, I think the folk people, you know, when Alice and I first started the show, I describe my family as the original locavores. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, it was all, there were,
it's true.
They were very, they grew, like your dad had a vegetable garden. My dad grew his own food. And one of the memories that Alice and I have together about, like, the kind of Italian food that we make is my dad takes cherry tomatoes off the plant, squishes them in his big meaty hand in a wide pan with olive oil and garlic and chopped up basil and a few other things.
It's the best sauce I've ever had.
Yeah, and tosses it with spaghetti and then some cheese. Like that,
This was the dish of my summer. This was the dish of my summer every year when I was growing up.
Yeah.
The raw tomato sauce with the hot spaghetti reminds me. It's just the flavor of southern, of summer for me when I was growing up. I mean, we made this all the time, either with, you know, cherry tomatoes or with my father's big beefsteak tomatoes that he'd drain. And he'd just chop them up, mix them exactly with olive oil, garlic, and basil usually, sometimes a little, you know, oregano or something. And that was it.
Yeah.
That was the whole dish. And it was so... Oh, yeah. The fragrance when the cool sauce hits the hot pasta.
Yeah.
And it opens up all the oil from the garlic, and it opens up the flavor from the olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just comes wafting up into your face, and it's just like it couldn't get any better. It was just so beautiful. It's the best ever.
It is the best ever.
And fast, can I might add. It's extremely
really fast. Yeah. Well, yeah, you go grab the tomatoes from the backyard. You chop them up.
Yeah. The heart, the longest part is just waiting for the water to boil for the pasta.
Yeah.
Right.
It was, Alice always mentions that to me. Like, I have to make that.
It's
like,
the best. For me, it was just growing up in the South. It was just biting into a tomato with salt on it. Like, that's all. That's what the summer is to me. That's my tomato memory. You know.
Well, you're talking about in New York or in Italy?
No, I'm talking about the South of the United States. I'm not Italian at all. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't recognize your voice.
Carmen was Carmen. Carmen has introduced me to the finer points of the tomato, in that you can, you know, flavor it with these fresh herbs.
Yeah.
Well, I remember kids in my neighborhood making, and I loved these sandwiches. They were
tomato
sliced tomato. Yeah. Mayonnaise, and Wonder Bread.
Yeah.
And that was it. And I thought these sandwiches were fantastic.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, they're really delicious.
Right.
And we didn't really have those in, you know, my family, but we more have, you know, mozzarella or olive oil or on a bruschetta, they're like a toast more.
But
more
see,
often.
That's what the Italians
bring. But
those
were heaven.
Yeah.
The mayonnaise sandwiches.
Oh,
yeah. But it stops there with the Americans. Like,
yes.
Like, we, because we don't have the herbs, the native herbs that Italy
has. And you don't
have
olive oil.
Exactly.
You didn't use olive oil, and you wouldn't necessarily use garlic. You could use onion.
Right. Right,
yeah.
But it's not the same as the like richness of the Italian cuisine. So.
Well, I have to say, as an Italian American, which is how I think about myself, I am so grateful that my dad brought us here because, like you, I got to be introduced in New York to every kind of ethnic food and to let that color my cooking in ways that my parents would never. Do my grandparents definitely? It was extremely rote. It was like the joke was chicken or rabbit. You know what I mean? Like, and it was cooked a certain way, and you know there were certain things that were eaten, and that was it. You know, and part of it was cultural, part of it was economic. You know, they only ate what they grew themselves and produced. Mm-hmm. You know, the family myth is that the only things that they ever bought were matches and salt. Every single other thing, you know, they...
Oh, my family was a little different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my parents came here, and I think they clung to these traditions so well because it was so unfamiliar, and so they definitely stuck to it. But over time, as they also kind of got more integrated and more Americanized, they started branching out, especially my dad. And now the hilarious thing is when he goes to Italy, what everyone wants him to make... every time he goes is buffalo chicken wings. I know it sounds really crazy.
Oh, my God. Well, but that would be so exotic. I can imagine.
Yeah. They're like, Mario, you have to bring that sauce and make the wings. And that's all they want. He buys like thousands of chicken wings. He brings the buffalo sauce from New York in his suitcase. And they just die for it, Erica. They love it.
I can totally see that. I can completely see that.
Well, that smoky flavor. You don't get that smoky flavor in Italy. Like
No, they don't get that smoky flavor. Yeah. Like they're burning down the fields or something.
Right. Yeah. No, so it's just, so anyway, I want to ask you about, like, we talked about improvisation. So everybody who has a garden and that grows vegetables always has, like, a sort of overabundance of something, right? Whatever it is.
Like 6-foot-long zucchini plants?
Yes. Like, my mother insists on growing these pumpkins that all of us hate, and then
the pumpkins.
Freaking
it's
hate
like,
those pumpkins.
What do you pumpkins. Do with those things?
So they weigh like 100 pounds, and I don't like the taste of them. I only really like zucchini as a, you know, or acorn squash or those fall ones. But she grows these giant watery things, and then she foists them on my sister and I. Make something. And I was like, I don't want to make pumpkin soup.
It's like what is this, that Southern Italian saying, you know, you can, I don't remember exactly what it is, but it's about pumpkins. You can put, you know, you can dress it up, you can dress it up, but a pumpkin, it will always remain.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Once a pumpkin, always a pumpkin.
Exactly. So, well, one of the sort of pumpkin groups that a lot of gardeners have excess amount in the summer is zucchini, right?
Yes, everybody.
So I was thinking maybe you could share with us a different way or a different ingredient flavor combination that people can use if they have, like, way too many zucchini on their hands.
Well, that's interesting. I actually just about 2 weeks ago, I bought a ton of zucchinis at upstate, actually, at some farm. And I brought them back, and I was going through them in my usual way. And then I was thinking, you know, I want to do something else. And I came up with this recipe that sort of, it uses a Parmesan and cream to make sort of a zucchini custard type thing.
Oh, my God.
I suppose it's on my blog. I don't remember. I think I may have called it a sformata, which is like a form in Italian, a mold.
Yeah.
Is that what the word means? Yes.
Yes.
And but a sformata in Italian usually refers to something that's a custard that's the whole thing is pureed throughout and then baked.
Right.
But this thing, I cut the zucchini into little chunks and sauteed them with onion and garlic and herbs. I used marjoram, I remember, and maybe thyme too. I'd have to go check. And then I poured a cheesy Parmesan-y custard with eggs over it, almost like more like a clafouti.
Yes,
in French cooking, you know.
Yes, I made those.
Yeah, like a savory clafouti, and I baked it, and it was really good. It was it made the zucchini taste sweet, and it was very creamy and not what I usually do with zucchini. I would more often mix it with, you know, do it with pasta, do it with some hot peppers, put a lot of, you know, maybe strong flavors in with it.
Yeah.
Because it's such a gentle tasting thing. My grandmother always made stuffed zucchini, which I loved.
Yeah.
That had sausage in it. She made ones that had rice in them, too. And I love those. But I was looking for something different, and I came up with this. And I thought it came out really nice.
I think that sounds like something my 3-year-old would eat.
Yeah.
Because
it's a real kid-friendly thing. Yeah. I can see it. Because it's very mellow. But yet it's sophisticated.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's actually, I served it as a side dish for something. Lamb chops, I think, maybe. And then I just had that and the zucchini thing and a salad. It was really nice.
I love that.
I'm gonna look that up.
That
sounds great.
So I can't believe the 45 minutes has just flown by, Erica.
Oh, really?
I know.
Oh, how sad.
All right, one more, Carmen. One more.
Okay. One more recipe.
Item two.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay. We love our summer fruits too. So we're gonna go a little bit over because the engineer is not giving us darty eyed looks yet.
That's good.
Raspberries. Okay, that usually is overabundant. You know.
Yeah.
And so, what do we do with raspberries if we have, like, way too many?
Well, You know, what I've been doing lately since I have my herb garden is I've been pairing berries with herbs. My father used to make this thing. I bet your parents made this too. Every summer, this is another great taste of summer. Peaches in red wine.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. And my father always put basil in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He just chopped basil up, put it in. And that was like the most fantastic summer dessert ever. And it wasn't sweet. I don't think he put extra sugar in it. I think it was just the wine. I don't think he added sugar. And so I'm thinking with raspberries, I would try pairing it with an herb, and maybe like a sugar reduction, like a simple syrup with an herb in it, like maybe basil, actually, mm-hmm. or tarragon, actually, would
Ooh.
Be probably beautiful
with
raspberries. Mm-hmm. Or just do a little wine. Now, I think with raspberries, I wouldn't just use the raw wine. I would make like a simple syrup reduction with a little wine and some herbs in it.
That sounds
and
good.
And then maybe chill it so it got some thickness to it, then poured it over the raspberries. So you have sort of a not terribly sweet, but a little bit more of a complex taste.
Yes. Because raspberries aren't that sweet. The raspberries, what I love about them as a fruit is that they're not too sweet.
Thai basil, I bet, would be great with raspberries.
Thai basil, yes, because it's not so full, you know.
Right. Imagine that over a little ice cream or gelato.
Yes.
Right, you know, regular basil has, what is it? It's the oil that's in clove, I believe.
Yes.
It's the same oil that's in basil.
It's strong.
It's strong, and the Thai basil is different. It tastes a little bit more like anisey to me.
Yes, it definitely
does. And then clovey, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. So maybe with the raspberries, make a little simple syrup with a little bit of maybe rosé wine even.
Yes.
Cook it down, chill it, and then scatter Thai basil over the raspberries and then pour the syrup over it.
Done.
And then just serve it, right?
That
Done.
Sounds great.
All right. Well, Erica, thank you so much for being on the show. We're going to put a link.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been great.
I couldn't think of a better partner to, you know, do a
summer pleasures.
To talk about summer pleasures.
Oh, well, I hope I was pleasurable enough.
You definitely were.
You got my mind thinking, and I'm excited to go home
good.
And cook.
So we're going to post a link to your blog.
Thank you.
On our Facebook page. We'd love to have you back maybe in the winter to talk about winter pleasures, you know?
Sure. Absolutely. I'll have to, you know, there are pleasures to be had in the cold weather.
There are pleasures, yes.
Well, thanks for being on the show.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
Have a nice summer.
Okay.
Okay, you too. Bye, guys.
Bye. So We Dig Plants has been written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg and engineered by Jeet Paul. Please remember to follow our Facebook page, Groundworks Inc. We Dig Plants, to stay current on our projects and upcoming shows. Follow us on Twitter at We Dig Plants and Instagram at
Groundworks Gardens NYC.
Thanks for listening and see you in the garden.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.